The topic of today's talk is our paper with joint, this part is a joint work with Dmitry Tamarkin from Northwestern. It's a paper on microlocal properties of sheaves in complex WKB. So the goal of this work is, well, the problem that we've been referring to a lot, Iwaki-san and myself, is the problem of existence of resurgent or duly analytically continuable solution of Schrödinger equation in the Laplace plane. Of course, everything that we were talking about really depends on the fact that solutions of the Schrödinger equation, once you Borel transform that, have this an endless analytic continuability property. Without property, nothing, no Stokes phenomenon, no splitting into, no possibility of writing this exponential asymptotic expansions that I drew yesterday. So all of that really depends on, crucially on this property. And this property, as far as I understand, was always believed in by physicists. People started really trying to write it up in the early 80s. There were several attempts, several texts, several partial solutions, which I will review in a bit. Many senior scientists, well, not many, how many do I know? Six or seven senior scientists, senior mathematicians, have believed in the last 5-6 years that they're just finishing the last bits of this proof. And I hope at the end it will work out that all of them will get credit for years and decades that they spent on this problem. But the problem really has, if you play with this for a while, you really see why the problem is really tries to trick you into believing that you are very close to solution. So the text that we have written, I'm not saying it's a good text. I'm not saying it's a text that is readable humanly. I'm not saying that's a text that answers all the question, but I'm personally responsible that there are no miracles happening anywhere in this text. So this is a mathematically fully solid text, and at least in that regard, and that's the merit of it. So. So published an asterisk, if you are okay with a couple of typos, it's also in the archive. So the problem that we are going to be studying is the problem motivated by one-dimensional Schrödinger equation. It's no longer within Laplace, and it's anything like this. XH. So I'm going to Laplace transform it in the spirit of my yesterday's talk. I tried, I guess, to convince you that it was possible to not discuss questions of Borel summability. And well, you get weaker results, but at least that. So we can Borel transform it and cheating you by a couple of derivatives. The equation that we have to solve in the Borel plane, so H will be, I guess like this, 1 over H will be replaced by the dual variable s in the Laplace picture, cheating you by a couple of derivatives. The equation that we have to solve is this. And we are going to be solving this equation in the class of ramified analytic functions. So a little bit more about what this means in a couple of minutes. So, so what does it mean that What it means a ramified multivalued analytic function? It means that over the complex plane of, not everybody likes this notation, but I do. So, and I'm the speaker. So I will consider, this will be a complex plane with two coordinates x and s, okay? So that means if I want to define a ramified analytic function multivalued, that means I need to present a manifold s on which it will honestly be defined, and then a projection. And this projection would have to be a local biholomorphism. And so then what I should do, I should take this equation, so at least post factum. So once you have constructed this manifold correctly, you post factum, you pull back this equation onto this manifold via this biholomorphic map. There will be an equation here that will be satisfied by some solution, and that is the solution that is, I think, appropriate to call a ramified analytic solution of the original equation. So, okay. Quick review of the status of the problem, at least at the time when we were working on it. So first of all, many of you have read the book of Kawai and Takei, and at least have seen that there is an Airy function example. Okay, previous work maybe like this. So starting from 19th century, Airy, Bessel, all those classical special functions lead to the equation of this type for specific v of x. And for those equations, if you Laplace transform this, this psi will have a specific closed form solution. And analytical continuability of psi, of this psi, is just studied by looking at the closed formula. Closed form solution. One of the works that I haven't read in detail is Schaffke and Fruchart, I think 2009, where V is a double well potential. And as far as I understand, the closed form solution is not so closed. It's some sort of really big series, but at least it can be analyzed. Other partial solution is Cauchy-Kovalevsky theorem. I will need it anyway, so let me state what it does. So given an equation like that, well, so far I have just stated you the equation. Cauchy problem in the partial differential equations also involves the initial condition. And the initial condition, this is an order two differential equation, so I need to give you a hypersurface, complex hypersurface, and give you an initial condition there for the function and for the derivative perpendicular to the surface. So here's what I'm going to take. I'm going to take x0, the initial point. And for it's convenient to take it not to be the turning point. And I'm going to say that psi xs at x0 is equal to, let's say, psi0. And I'm going to say that psi zero of s, psi x s is equal to psi one of s. Just setting up the initial condition. So one should think of x zero as x one as something like one over s or logarithm of s. So it has to, via the Laplace transform that used in WKB, it should correspond to 1 or h or something. So one should not think of psi 0 of s as an entire function. So psi 0, psi 1, at least one of them has to have singularities. Anyhow, so Cauchy-Kovalevsky theorem, what does it give us for this kind of equation? So picture. So, of course, I'm in a complex two dimension, but picture is inevitably real two dimension, right? So this is x0, the initial point. The initial data, well, it will have singularities. So let me draw with the red chalk where the initial data is defined, let's say here. And let's say there will be a singularity there. Then the Cauchy-Kovalevsky theorem tells us that the solution exists in a neighborhood of the initial hypersurface. So in this case, the solution will exist here, right? So you take a neighborhood, and the solution will exist there. So you see Cauchy-Kovalevsky theorem doesn't even give you a solution in a neighborhood in x variable times the s-axis. Even the thickness of this neighborhood is not uniform. So, and because we want to study the solutions of our differential equation globally in x, the answer is too local. As far as I understand the works of Kyoto School, and maybe barbarizing it a little bit, not a little bit, quite a bit, I guess. They study the properties of the formal solution, which means that they take, as far as I understand, this differential equation, they solve it formally, get the formal WQB expansions, and then they look at how it's barbarization, but nevertheless, they look at the properties of those WQB asymptotics, prove more or less that the terms in the WQB asymptotics grow more than factorially, and via the Borel transform conclude that there is something in the Borel plane in the size of a disk. So, and then as far as again, I understand philosophy of the further attempts is to push it a little bit beyond the disk, but that is the, properties of formal solutions. And then, So the paper the work from which this whole thing started for me is the work of the book of Shatalov and Sternin. Oh, I should of course mention Ekal. Ekal's papers are, well, difficult to read, right? So there was a claim of endless analytic continuability in one of those, but I don't think it was accepted by the community. Shatalov's Sternin book was where this topic started from me. And I think it's good to review what they do because they, it's good to review. You'll see why. So how do we solve, for those of you who teach rigorous differential equations, how do we prove in the undergraduate course existence of solutions? So we take a differential equation, something like, let's see if I'm prepared for, so suppose we have a linear differential equation, let's say f prime is equal to af, just linear, but a can depend on a coefficient and x. So we transform this into an integral equation. So we take up, we start with some function, let's say zeroth iteration. Notation does not correspond to that. So let's say phi zero, some constant or something, doesn't matter. Well, matters a little bit for convergence equations, but take some function, for example, a constant. Then integrate both sides. And then you rewrite this as an integral equation. So f of x is equal to constant, right, plus the integral from x0, where the initial data is given, to x a t f of t dt. And this integral equation allows you to set up infinitely many iterations. So hopefully what you get is f of x is, I don't know, c0, or maybe, I guess I shouldn't do it. So maybe just C0, which would be initial condition. C0 plus the integral x0 to x at x C0 dt plus the iterated integral from to x d x1, maybe like this, from 0 to x1 dx2. This would be the nth term. And from 0 to xn, dx, sorry. Important. Let me try again. From 0 to x, dx1, a of x1, the integral from 0 to x1, ax2, dx2. So, and then you get n-fold an iterated integral of this shape. And then what you show is that, at least in the case of differential equations of one variable, that the series converges and converges factorially, provided a of x is bounded. And so this is the proof for the ordinary differential equation. Now, Shatalov and Sternin attempted to imitate the same kind of idea for this equation. So what they did, they took, they treated d of s like just an operator floating around, and they considered this just as an operator, and they considered it as a differential equation of order 2 with respect to dx, And then after a page of calculation, not so enlightening, but I hope this motivates it enough, they have written down the solution, at least formally, in terms of an iterated integral. Let me show you the kind of beast that they get. And I'm going to be cheating here and there. But okay, so first of all, notation, and I will, well, maybe here, notation that I will be using. So given a Schrödinger operator of that type, there is a phase function, right, S of x, and I will need this notation later on. So I take the point where my initial conditions are given, and x0 to x, root, I never remember, plus or minus, forgive me, a factor of I or a factor of minus, okay? So this will be the classic collection. There are two choices of roots, and this is defined on the universal cover we take a complex plane of X, subtract turning points, and take the universal cover, right? So this function will be needed in a second. Well, it will be needed, of course, for the rest of the talk. So here's what they do. So instead of those iterated integrals, they take two differential operators, R1 and R2, two because there are two determinations of the square root. I'll just say Rj, and I will say that S of j is equal to, the two determinations. So S is equal to S, S1 is equal to S, and S2 is equal to minus S, where my S is on that board. So so this is going to be the, and so I will need to apply it to a function psi xs. Here there's just the function of one variable. Here it's going to be the function of two variables, but s is just floating around. So integration is going to be from x0 to x, psi, and now help me God, x plus, s plus I like that. I think like that. I'm just shifting it here, so bear with me here for a moment. And then they write this kind of differential operator. That's an integral operator. There is a prefactor which I'm missing here. Some prefactor which matters but not too much for this story. And so there will be some function. There will be some function of x. Function of x build of the potential. I think something like on the level of classical momentum or root of the classical momentum, some unenlightening factor. And then what they do, unfortunately for us, they miss here the derivative with respect to the second argument. So without the derivative with respect to the second argument, they see, oh, that situation is very close, very similar to the previous one, a factorially convergent series, done, right? With this factorial, with this missing the derivative, so when you differentiate a function, its estimates get worse, and so this destroys their argument. However, I didn't tell you which argument. So once they have this sort of operators, they say that the solution of our equation over there can be constructed in the following way. So we take some solution f of s that is constructed from the initial data, or maybe I just should say psi of s. Psi of s. ML, well, we have the initial data, PC1 and PC2, so I'll just use maybe those. They write down the solution of the equation in the following form. So there will be a sum. Sum will run over, cheating you a little bit, over all possible combinations, Ri1, Ri2, Rin, those iterations of this integral operator, applied to either Psi0, Psi1. Of S. So the sum is taken more or less over all possible such words and the initial data. And then there is also some junk floating around, some prefactors. But you get the formula in terms of iterated integrals. Without this, it would have converged factorially. With this, no. And I1, IN are one or two. So, however, so why am I talking about this proof that didn't work out? Because philosophically, this is what we have developed further. So, first of all, let us consider a little bit the features of this formula. The features, feature number one, so here in that example, in one variable real differential equation, there was no question whatsoever along which path we're integrating. Right, so if it's one real variable, there's one path. In complex, when I'm writing x0 to x1, we should think of x0 and x as points in the complex plane, right? So there are already many paths. And the integrand has singularities. So it does matter that this integration path never hits the singularity of the integrand. And it also matters how to, which way it goes around every singularity. So here, one of the things that in order to clarify this formula should be to really understand the integration paths. And integration paths is one of the reasons why this problem is complicated, because the combinatorics of those integration paths is also quite complicated. Maybe just you will allow me a couple of minutes of illustration what I'm talking about. So let us take this Stokes pattern. Let us take this to be our initial point. Let us take our initial data so that at the initial point in the Borel plane, we just have one singularity, let's say at zero. At the point x0, we just have one singularity at zero. So then what happens if we start moving the pointer, moving the point a little bit? So here, near the, in the same Stokes region, maybe I'll just draw it here, slightly away. So we will have two singularities located where one singularity is going to be located at SX, and the other is going to be located at minus SX, right? Right, the singularity splits in two, and the singularities propagate along the characteristics. So this is our point x, let's say. Suppose you are trying to draw the integration path that would fulfill that that would work for in that iterative formula. That would be valid for all values of S. So this is complex plane of S. This is complex plane of S. That would be valid for all points in this red rectangle. So then, if you play a little bit with this formula, what you have to do is you have to map this rectangle into the complex plane here. It will get mapped like this. And so the integration path that you need to draw will be this integration path. And this integration path, if you look at the second argument, this integration path should be thought of as lying on the plane S plus, J should be here. So this is S, so it's either S plus S of T or S minus S of T. My apologies for this. Right? So integration path, if you look at it like a complex two-dimensional path, lies either on the plane, on the, I'll just maybe write down this a little bit like this. Integration path lies on the surface S plus Sj, and Sj is plus or minus that S of X equal to constant. So apart from lying on that surface, it also has to avoid the singularities like here. And so once again, this one more detail. This point is the turning point. This is a point where some of the coefficients in that iterated integral become singular. So when your S approaches this point or tries to cross the Stokes curve, this integration path gets pinched by that singularity, and that creates these singularities on the Borel plane. I don't know if I'm explaining it very clearly, but at least what I want you to get from this exposition. So the integration, there are iterated integral formula, problematic, but there is. Integration paths lie along such surfaces. And then pinching of those integration paths creates singularities. Okay. So Shatalov,
In your past picture, you mean explaining with the dotting sent origin. That origin corresponds to a singular point.
Yes. So if we are solving this solution, if we're solving this equation. Let's, for example, phi 0 is equal to 1 over s, c 0, right? And c 1 equal to 0. Oh, sorry, you don't see. C 0 is equal to 1 over s, and c 1 equal to 0. So at the initial point, the singularity will be in the origin.
You are assuming the initial data
singularity. Yes. Okay, so, and then of those approaches, maybe I should also mention the book of Simpson, which I learned about quite later than we finished the work. So I haven't read the book, so I don't know what's really exactly done there. But what is claimed is that he is able to construct analytic continuation to the region of this type. Again, so what is really contained there may be more than this or less than this, but, well, hopefully more. But this is the kind of domain to which the red domain is the domain that where he claims he knows to, how to construct analytic continuation of Borel solutions. So our ambition is, however, to construct. Well, you'll see the statement. Our statement is stronger than this. Okay, so Simpson, Carlos Simpson. All right, so. Excellent question. So as you will see in our method, any type of singularity is allowed.
But not even isolated.
No, it has to be isolated.
So that's what I'm asking. What kind of singularity is allowed?
So let us, let me just maybe write the assumption because I will write them anyway. So sorry for a bit of disorganization, but maybe it's a good way to say. So assumption. Or rather first notation. I will call the sector S alpha to be the et al sector. Okay, maybe like this. Right. So this will be the sector from goes from minus alpha all the way around zero to 2 pi plus alpha. So if you want to be more formal, let me take S alpha to be the strip, imaginary part of Z greater than minus alpha less than alpha plus 2 pi. And let me map it exponentially to the, let me map it exponentially to the complex plane of S. Okay, this is. And so I'm going to assume that my initial data, Psi 0 of S, Psi 1 of S, are holomorphic on this sector. Okay. okay. Alexander. So the machinery that we are going to be using for this work is the theory of microlocal properties of sheets. And here's what this machine does. So mostly in also in Kyoto and in Paris, people have been looking abstractly at the question of solutions and propagation of singularities of this kind of differential equation. They've been doing it in the 60s, I think, 70s, 80s. They have developed a machinery that in principle should answer all questions. The ambition of that theory is that given any kind of equation of this type, solution properties of ramified solutions and their singularities should be studied using this machine. This machine is formulated in terms of D modules and in terms of sheaves of solution. So first of all, well, maybe without writing many more definitions, let's look at this. So this, so if you look at this as an equation of C, so this is an equation in C2, so in on a complex plane. So holomorphic solutions of this equation form a sheaf, right? Sheaf of what? Sheaf of vector spaces. For people, for algebraic geometers in the audience, these are in no way coherent sheaves. These are sheaf of vector spaces, right? So yeah. And the machine that they have delivered is the following. So they study the sheaf. So how do I denote it? F. Solution sheaf of my differential equation. And the machine that they have delivered gives the following result. So suppose you have an open set. Well, first of all, I will tell the, okay, let's see how it comes out. So suppose you have the basic philosophy of what's hidden in that machine is this. Suppose you have, this is an open set in C2, where the equation is defined. And suppose you have a solution on this open set. And suppose you want to know if this solution can be analytically continued to the nearby point. Then what you do, you set up the differential, you set up, let's say here, nearby. You set up a Cauchy problem with the data here. Then you write down this integral expansion, iterated integral expansion. And in order to reach this point, start drawing the integrals along the curves, along this curve. You start drawing the curves from the set on which you know the solution to the point where you want to know the solution along these curves. There will be no, if everything is close enough, there will be no issue with pinching contours or additional singularities. If everything is closed enough, this sum will converge. So you draw integration paths in one direction, and you draw integration paths in the other direction. And you make sense locally in a small neighborhood, you can make full precise sense of that corrected formula. And so locally, you can extend your solution from here to there. Unless you cannot reach this point by the curves of this type. So in the case of a second order equation that forbids you from at every point of the boundary, it forbids you to going into two codirections, codirections given by this formula. So it tells you pretty much that if you have an open set on which you know the solution, except you can extend this solution except in two exceptional directions, actually co-directions. Okay. So and this motivates.
These curves are the characteristic curves.
Yes. Yes, sir. Yeah. And this motivates the following definition: singular support of F of this of our solution sheaf is equal to. And let me just write it formally. In this case, it is equal to the characteristic variety of this differential equation. So in this case, so first of all, this is going to be a subset in T star of C2 of and now help me God to write everything correctly, X, S. Now I'm taking the two dual variables, Xi and Sigma, so I should just write down minus C squared, right, plus V of X sigma squared equal to zero. So you see what I did? I took the equation, I replaced the highest order derivative by that, and so this is the singular support. So, and pretty much I explained all to you already also the definition of singular support. So if you have a sheaf, forget about differential equations. You have a sheaf. What is it at singular support? So if you, first of all, you take an open set, you take a boundary point, you take, I don't know how to draw covectors, but it's a covector. And so the direction is singular if, the direction is called singular if the restriction map, sorry, there is a little bit with this, if the restriction map to this smaller set is not a quasi-isomorphism. It has to be, properly, it has to be done in the derived category in order to get good properties. So if, so basically if you can extend or shrink your set in the given direction without changing the derived sections of your sheaf, then this is a non-singular direction, and with a singular, if this changes, it lies in the singular support, and in particular case of differential equation, singular supports is known by hard analytic work, and in the heart of that analytic work is that iteration formula. So, which makes the, and for us, this does all the analysis. So from this point on, using the work of Kashiwara, Shapira, and others, we can forget completely about the analysis, because now we just have a sheaf of solution. We know its topological properties. We know how it extends a little bit analytically, how the solutions extend. And we just work with that. Okay. One important remark is that if here I had any sort of polynomial in H, any addition, let's say VH of V1 of X, anything of, let's say I had an extra term like this, it wouldn't have changed anything because only the principal symbol of this equation affects the singular support, right? So if adding other analytic terms doesn't change anything. Another thing that is both, that one of the reasons that these techniques of singular support proven successful is that once we pass to the from function to the singular support, what do we forget about the function? We completely forget its growth rate, and we completely forget its singularity structure. So if the function is singular at a point, we only see that this element of the sections of a sheaf cannot be contained to extended to a point. So we don't know what kind of singularities there are. It can be logarithmic, it can be highly transcendental, whatever. So, but this is also achieves the simplification with which one can work. Okay, so I want to maybe set up the, so far we were talking about solutions, but we also have initial condition in our story. This is how I propose to handle the initial condition. So we have this point in which the initial condition is given. Then I have this sector S alpha. So what happens is that we have a Cauchy-Kovalevsky theorem. So X zero, and sorry, it doesn't look it this way, but I want the horizontal direction to represent S alpha, which is this two-dimensional sector, right? So here, I'm going to be working on a complex plane of X times this S alpha. So on S alpha, we have initial data. analytic initial data, and in this manifold on S alpha cross SSX, we have the Cauchy-Kovalevsky theorem. And the Cauchy-Kovalevsky theorem gives us existence of an analytic solution on a some neighborhood of the initial data. So in other words, if F is the solution sheaf, it's already here somewhere, right? F is the solution sheaf of my differential equation on C2. Then what would that represent? So if we take an obvious map to C2, so which means on the first coordinate, just embedding of the point, on the second coordinate, projection of the sector, sometimes 1-to-1, sometimes 2-to-1 to the complex plane of S, right? Then this what the Cauchy-Kovalevsky theorem gives us will be a solution of the pullback equation. So Cauchy-Kovalevsky theorem, so initial data plus Cauchy-Kovalevsky theorem gives us a solution psi, which will be a section on this open set. How do I denote this? Maybe G of the sheaf G minus 1 F. Okay. Now, these are sheaves. Third, there is a six functor formalism, right? So pullbacks, two pullbacks, duality, blah, 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 Holmes. So playing a little bit with the six functor formalism, non-enlightening to me at all, but works out at the end. We get the following thing, which encodes the initial data. F is a script F, sorry. And this would be a morphism on C2. Okay. This step is just purely, to me, it's purely formal, so it just works. So in other words, we have now, yeah?
By minus two.
I also need to tell you of what, right? Sorry about this. Thank you. It's constant sheaf on this creature, and minus two. There are different physical interpretation of minus two, but here two is the codimension of a point x0 in the complex plane of x. Okay. Good. And now the following becomes the main insight and the main technology that my senior co-author brought into this project. And the following theorem is not going to be the abstract nonsense. It is really the heart and the muscle, the abstract muscle of this work. Sorry, one more piece of notation that I've been postponing for as much as possible. So this is going to be, I will call this X, okay? So in fact, what I'm going to be solving is this equation. Where is my I? I never have such a luxury of blackboards. So I'm going to be, in fact, solving this equation on X. So in other words, I take this thing, remove the turning points, and so my X coordinate from now on will be in that universal color. So the main abstract muscle of this work is the following theorem. Well, one more maybe definition. C is going to be the category, so the full subcategory of Well, I have to work with derived category. We have to work with the derived category. With singular support in this characteristic variety with singular support of those sheaves contained in this minus c squared plus v of x sigma squared equal to zero. With this, so we take the sheaves with singular support in that sense contained in this characteristic variety and form complexes, form complexes whose cohomologies have this singular support.
Is this derived category constructible?
No, sheaves of vector spaces.
Sheaves of vector spaces.
So the cohomologies, so there's no, I see.
Sheaves of vector spaces.
Maybe
abelian groups.
I don't know what's in the final version.
But
same story. Abelian groups, maybe. So there is a distinguished triangle in the category in this category. In here. So this is the sheaf that this is the sheaf, right? This sheaf that helps us encode the initial data. And then like this. So we are able to decompose this sheaf as a distinguished triangle called semi-orthogonal decomposition. My board is a mess, sorry. Don't erase in your notes. I'll just need to organize a little bit better what I have already written. Semi-orthogonal decomposition. So this sheaf that helps us encode the initial data. And then two other complexes of sheaves. So this will be in the category. It will have the singular support, the same as the solutions of our differential equation. And this will be in the left orthogonal complement. That left orthogonal complement to this category means that there is no morphism from delta to anything in this category. So why does it solve the problem? I mean, and then we work for like 80 pages constructing this thing. So why does it solve the problem? This kind of semi-orthogonal decomposition possesses a universality property. So our initial condition are encoded in such a morphism, right? This is the initial condition. So initial condition plus analytic Cauchy-Kovalevsky theorem that solves our equations locally, right? To F, right? And this is the universality property. There is exist. This is in the right category. This is in category C. By universality property, which is I think five-minute exercise in universality properties, there is a morphism like this. So how does this help? So far I have been playing with sheaves, but I still haven't told you on which manifold the solution will be defined. And so as a manifold, we take the too much board really makes me overly messy, but okay, let's see. So phi is, turns out phi is concentrated in degrees zero and above. So we can take the zeroth component, the zeroth cohomology of phi. And now we take the manifold S to be the et al. Space of phi zero, right? So first of all, where does phi zero live? Phi zero is a sheaf on X cross C. So the X coordinate times the Borel plane. So S is the et al. Space of some sheaf. Et al. Space are always manifolds. And if you have an et al. Space of a sheaf, then you will also get a biholomorphic, well, it's locally homeomorphic, right? Et al. Spaces. So this is a manifold. And this is a manifold that goes to X cross C. Right? So now, let us take this morphism. Let us pull it back. And let me call this pi projection. So, moreover, phi zero, so pi zero, pi minus one of phi zero has a canonical section, tautological section. Okay. This tautological section now, if we pull back this morphism to, I need a letter, U. So if we take P minus one U, then this will be a morphism from the pullback of this to pullback of that. Here we have a tautological section. Then the image of that tautological section will give us a section of this P minus one of F. So sorry, I should write P minus one of F. So P minus one of the tautological section. I should say P minus one of U of the tautological section of the sheaf of this pi minus one of P is a section of pi minus one of F. In other words, and this is a sheaf of solutions, in other words, it is a solution of the differential equation. Because this formal, and now this formalism, creating this formalism is non-trivial, but the rest is abstract nonsense. An exercise, half a page in abstract nonsense, shows that this is the solution, that this section represents the solution with the initial data given initially. So, so the rest of the work and what I have explained maybe was the introduction and the reformulation to the of the problem. So the rest of the work is constructing this semi-orthogonal decomposition. So how is it constructed? So first of all, the absolutely important ingredient in the construction was the was the knowledge how this manifold S would have to look like. In other words, knowing how phi would have to look like, at least approximately. For that, we had to use as an input the paper of Voros of 1983. So phi is glued as, phi is glued. So you take this universal cover of the complex plane X. It's split into Stokes regions. On every Stokes region, we take direct sum of more or less constant sheaves. And then across the boundaries of the Stokes region, we glue those constant sheaves in order to imitate what the manifold looks like due to the Stokes phenomenon. All right, so. So pretty much we use that prescription due to Voros. The next point is to really proving that this belongs to C and the cone belongs to orthogonal complement of C. This work is also takes quite a while, and at the heart of it is the shift theoretic reformulation using singular support of this idea of deformations of contours. So sometimes you can deform a contour, sometimes you cannot deform a contour, and that gets reformulated into shift theoretic language. So with all of this done, there is a semi-orthogonal composition, and so far I didn't tell you anything about the analytic continuability property. However, so what do you need to know? What do you need to do in order to understand how big is this manifold S on which the solution is defined? You need to calculate the et al. Space of some sheaf, right? And the sheaf is made by gluing things, by pretty much gluing constant sheaves. Constant sheaves are not too complicated things like cones and just angles. And so this question, at least technologically, becomes a question of linear algebra. And it is possible to do the linear algebra without doing the analysis at this stage. So in other words, once again, the study of this manifold S becomes the study of linear algebra of just direct sums of complex sheaves. So all of this gets done, and so the final result is the following. Main part of the theorem. So suppose you have your point X anywhere in this universal cover. So this happens. This picture is going to be over X in X. And so suppose your solution, your sheaf, the solution of the differential equation is defined, let's say, on a neighborhood like this, on a circle. Then it is possible to extend this solution to a cone, to an angle like this, minus discretely many, finitely many cuts in the direction alpha. And the similar theorem says that you can also extend it to the same section. Can be extended to the same cone minus finitely many cuts in the direction minus alpha. So those two things together provide us with an analytic continuation of solution given on a such neighborhood to a cone minus finitely many cuts. So in other words, we have an analytic continuation to the essential part of the first sheet minus cuts. And plus a little bit, there is a little bit of analytic continuation beyond the first sheet. Small theorem, but it's also important. For every X, there is such a neighborhood, right? So what is worth how much in this paper? So if we did not want to really have the analytic continuation beyond the first sheet a little bit, the paper would have been 5 times quick and 5 times short. I would not have been using derived categories. So the reason for the appearance of derived categories is really this overlap in the initial data and the fact that all our sheaves, so for example, when we construct this sheaf, it really becomes a complex because this map is not one-to-one. So without this, the paper would have been, as I told you, 5 times quicker, 5 times shorter, and technically easier. But those of you who have played with complex WQB, you know that sometimes you really need the jump of the function between the two contours. What this paper does not, it does not the So, well, first of all, implicitly, we didn't really write it out or work it out, but implicitly, these locations of those singularities should be exactly the singularities predicted by Voros. So this paper does not tell us anything about Borel summability growth of solution at infinity, doesn't tell us anything about the type of the singularities that the solution will have. On the positive side, it does not also assume anything about the potential, except we don't want pathologies in the Stokes pattern. So for, in particular, for the Witten-Laplacian, where the potential is a trigonometric polynomial, so growing at infinity quicker than a polynomial, it still perfectly applies. And generalization to higher order equations would come if we have a prediction as clear as the prediction by Voros of what the Riemann surface of what the manifold would look like. And final remark, sorry. The thing that there are two things open for research, and I'm kind of thinking about one of them. The thing I'm thinking about is how to really control the propagation, how to really make sure that the singularities really have the type of logarithm times something, so that really give the usual WQB expansion. That's the question in second to microlocalization. Working and thinking about that. One more thing that one probably a conjecture, and probably this will be a very good step towards the solution of the problem once we really start working on it. So it seems like we don't really need to remove the, it seems that this part is unnecessary. We don't need to remove the turning points. But again, so, okay, so, yeah. Oh, sorry, I didn't want to applaud to myself. Sorry, sorry. I was just feeling.
Okay. Questions?
I couldn't get what do you think about high order.
So this work is based is one of the ingredients. We could not have done this work if we did not know where the singularities are located. Once we know how the singularities are located, we might be able to start working on the same statement for higher order equations. Until then, no. So this does not tell you anything about spectral networks or Stokes patterns. It uses this. But you see, the statement about the distinguished triangle is so general. I mean, it should. In the statement, there is nothing that tells you anything about. You see how general the statement is.
So often in the WKB literature, there's an argument about this type of extension, analytic continuation of the Borel plane, where you follow the method of characteristics and say basically that if you're at a non-singular point in the initial data, you just follow those characteristics and solve.
Yeah, that's what we've indicated.
So you're kind of, does this theorem place that on a firm foundation and say
yes?
As long as you can keep, I mean, just follow the characteristics and you can solve anywhere.
Well, what the statement that you're referring is a meta statement. And this is this meta statement turned into a theorem.
So there was even a point in Iwaki-san's lecture where he was explaining the proof of Koike and Shifke, where they used the method of characteristics to obtain the result.
So, yes, but so Koike, Shefke, and a couple of other, well, more than a couple of other people are really working hard on this problem. They have all various approaches, and I wish luck to all of them, and I hope all of them will get the credit for finalizing this problem when this problem is finalized.
So when you do this method of characteristics, it's usually some delicate analysis involved with the caustic line, right?
At the turning points.
Also along the caustics?
The turning points. No, this is the whole thing. So when I was, before I talked to Tamarkin and I was trying to work with, about this particular issue, and I was trying to do it analytically, the thing, there was somewhere, okay, yeah, this expansion. So here's what I think I know about this expansion and what scares me quite a bit. So this expansion, near the initial point, it converges indeed factorially, fine. But as soon as your point x starts approaching a Stokes curve, the convergence becomes at most geometric, at the best, as far as unless I made a mistake with the quotient 2/3. And if your potential is complicated, then you have many, many terms. Now, the reason why the expansion is complicated is that you have to draw those complicated paths. And the path that passes near the turning point is the one that contributes. In order to estimate that, you need to use the asymptotic scale in the following with quadruple asymptotic scale. Not like just, you know, sometimes you estimate something in terms of geometric series. But here you need to estimate something in terms of the metaphor, which will involve x, s, log x, log s. So you have an asymptotic scale with four parameters. And the combinatorics of paths, so thing that grows here will affect you something that grows there, that creates a quite a difficult combinatorics. And I guess that's what people who are doing it by analytic methods are fighting with. And in particular, was a result of Koike Kamimoto and maybe others, where they have a little bit, well, so poles in the X plane create a more benign analytic structure. And I think maybe in a different language, but that's why they were able to write some existence result because of the poles, because poles make it paradoxically better. And sorry, one of the works that I haven't mentioned is the work of Kostin Park Takei, so Ohio State and Kyoto, where they also did something along the iterated integrals, but they chose the region where they studied the convergence without this difficult combinatorics and difficult asymptotic scales. So the divergence and the reasons comes from really bad behavior of those iterated integrals, and in particular those coefficients near the turning points.
Any other questions? Okay. Let's thank him for amazing.